You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman, with a foreword by Stephen Covey. Last show, we were looking at multipliers and how they make companies better. We're looking at a specific type of multiplier now called the... Rather, we're going to look at someone that... a micromanager versus someone who is a multiplier investor. Multipliers operate as investors. They invest of themselves by infusing others with the resources and ownership that they need to produce results independent of the leader. It isn't just benevolence. They invest and they expect the best results from their people. Forever strong. Larry Gelwicks stood on the side of the rugby pitch, watching his high school team practice. He thought back to the first team he had coached, the national championships. He remembered them being up before dawn, training together. Larry said under his breath, "Well, that was then." The team in front of him was good, to be sure. They were learning the game. But he noticed that they didn't have the physical stamina of the previous teams. So Larry felt stuck. It wasn't like he hadn't tried. He reminded them at practice all the time. They would nod their heads, but they didn't do it. He could cancel practices and hold fitness training in its place, but that risks the skill level of the team. He could yell at them, but that would only work for a day or two. Larry leaned over to an associate coach and said, "We need to turn this over to the captains." The next day, Larry stood up, walked quickly to the chalkboard, and drew a line from one side of the board to the other. He said, quote, "We have only 6 weeks left until the finals, and it takes a pretty good athlete 6 or 7 weeks to build the endurance that they need," unquote. The coaches and captains were listening to every word. He continued, "If we figure this out now, we can win the nationals. If we can't, we'll be running on empty." Larry said, "There are only two options. The coaches can keep trying to figure something out, or you, as the captains, can take ownership for finding a solution. What should we do?" There was a pause. Then the captain of the backs said, "We'll take it on." Larry said, "Right now, I own this challenge. Once you take it on, you'll own it completely. We'll expect an update from you 2 weeks from today, but we won't bug the team at all." There was a silent agreement as the captains looked at each other, and the captains of the forwards stood up and went to the board. He turned to Larry, who sat down with the other coaches, and said, "Okay, we have a few questions." Larry and the coaches stayed and answered questions about the types of fitness training producing speed, agility, and endurance until eventually the coaches were excused and the four captains, all in their teens, stood in a semicircle around the chalkboard figuring it out. The solution they implemented was to divide the team into small groups of 4 to 6 people, each with its own leader. The captains would keep the subgroup leaders accountable, and the leaders would keep the players accountable. The smaller groups met before or after school for fitness training for weeks, and the teams soon became one of the fittest in the 34 years Larry had coached the team. They went undefeated all season and won the national championship. How would a micromanaging coach have approached the same problem? We don't need to wonder. Calling every play. Marcus Bolan shouted across the school at John Kimball, "Get over here." Marcus was a muscle head coach who wanted to micromanage every aspect of his team. He yelled at one of his team captains, "Don't ever hold a practice without me or you'll be off the team. We've probably already messed everyone up." Not surprisingly, John never tried anything original again. He and the other players slowly stopped taking initiative entirely. Playing for Marcus meant you did what he said without question. The endless laps at practice just had to be done. Even in the games, he called every play for every player. The team was so focused and dependent on Marcus, they couldn't think intelligently or adapt rapidly to changes on the field. As a result, they lost every game. Marcus took a group of players that had begun with a sense of ownership for the team and micromanaged it out of them. Interestingly, Marcus Dolan was later elected as the most losing coach in high school sports history by Sports Illustrated. Most interesting still, 8 of his players eventually left the team and went to play for Larry Gelwicks. In fact, they were on the team described earlier that woke before dawn to practice. They were the team that led Highland to its first national championship. Running onto the field. Why is it that when the stakes are high, so many managers jump in and take over? I've watched hundreds of youth soccer games, and I have to admit that I find myself watching the coaches more than the players. This is one of the curses of genius watching. I've seen a lot of very frustrated coaches during those games, when the team is down and playing horribly. I've seen crazy arm waving, copious shouting, and an occasional tantrum on the sideline. But I've never once seen a coach run out onto the field, steal the ball away from a player, and drive down the field and score. It has just never happened. Yet each one of these coaches has the skills required to score the game-winning goal, and I'm sure a few have been tempted to. So why didn't they? Beyond the obvious reason that it is against the rules, it simply isn't their role. Their job is to coach, and their player's job is to play. What perhaps isn't so obvious is why, when the stakes are so high, so many managers and organizations don't hesitate to run onto the playing field, steal away the ball, and score the winning goal. Managers are tempted to jump in because it isn't illegal, and many of them can't resist the lure to do so. Here's some examples. A sales manager who doesn't see fast enough progress in an important prospective client jumps into the sales process trying to win the deal himself. A marketing vice president watches one of her people stumble as he presents the new product go-to-market plan to the CEO, who begins firing tough questions at him. The marketing VP, fearing the CEO will lose confidence in her staff, jumps in and not only answers the tough questions, but finishes the presentation. At this point, you might ask yourself, how would I coach if I could never step out onto the playing field? How would I lead if I couldn't jump in and take over? How would I respond to a performance gap if I were a multiplier? Multipliers understand that their role is to invest, to teach, and to coach. And they keep the accountability for the play with players. By doing so, they create organizations that can win without them on the field. Let's now explore the discipline of the investor and how multipliers create organizations that can perform and win, not only without them on the field, but long after their direct influence is felt. The investor. Ila Bhatt is a slight 28-year-old Indian woman who is soft-spoken to the point of seeming almost fragile. She lives in the simplest two-bedroom bungalow where her bed doubles as a desk chair. She grew up listening to her teachers speak of India's struggle for independence, and her parents tell stories of her grandfather joining the 24-day salt march from Mohandas K. Gandhi's ashram in Ahmedabad to the Arabian Sea to make salt a symbolic defiance of the British law. In order to gain first-hand experience with rural poverty, Ila went to live in the villages of India and saw for herself that the political independence gained from British rule was just not enough. Economic independence would be the next victory. In the villages, she saw both the vibrancy and the struggle of the self-employed seamstresses, street vendors, and construction workers, and in response founded the Self-Employed Women's Association, or SEWA, in 1972, which gradually became a significant union in this region. It would have been far too easy for Ella to be elected General Secretary of SEWA every 3 years, as dictated by law, forever. In this way, she could have owned the organization's agenda indefinitely and just assigned tasks to everyone else. SEWA, after all, was her creation. It had evolved slowly in her mind, and it would have been understandable, if not expected, for her to remain its formal leader in perpetuity. Yes, Ila insisted on turning over the responsibility for running SEWA to new and younger leadership. She personally invested the time and energy into training and educating members about the democratic process and encouraged everyone to gain the political literacy needed to step up and run for one of the open positions. In a fascinating embodiment of SEWA's mission and management philosophy, Jyoti Makwan, who enrolled as a member of SEWA as a poor Gujarati-speaking cigarette-rolling worker, went on to become the English-speaking General Secretary for SEWA. In this role, she has led the union, which at the most recent election involved 1.2 million people. Jyoti could have spent her work years figuring out how to survive from day to day. But because of Ila's leadership, she has used her intellect solving complex problems that reach across international boundaries and affect more than 1 million women like herself. She recently stood shoulder to shoulder with Ila and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as they answered questions at a press conference. Jyoti's story is just the beginning. If you look at the second generation of chief executives of all the SEWA organizations, they all first worked under Ella's tutorage, which was given greater and greater ownership as they matured into capable managers. Each time Ila established an institution, she invested in the future leaders who allowed her to step away from the operational management. The succession was handled so gracefully that she could leave with confidence that her presence would still be felt as she is elsewhere investing her energy in establishing another institution. The SEWA union was followed by a bank created from 4,000 women, each depositing 10 rupees. And this has been followed by the Gujarat Mahila Housing Sewa Trust and the Gujarat State Mihila Sewa Cooperative Federation, Sewa Insurance, Sewa Academy, HomeNet South Asia, and many, many others. ELA continues to invest in building leaders and organizations that can operate independently for her. Her influence is like that of a parental figure giving guidance when people ask for it. She is there when she is needed. Her approach to management is the outgrowth of her simple motto, quote, "A leader is someone who helps others lead." How does a leader like ELA create other leaders who can assume ownership and deliver on the mission of the organization themselves? We find answers in these three practices of the investor, which is the next thing we're going to be looking at.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman, with a foreword by Stephen R. Covey. Now we're looking at the three practices of the investor, which is a particular type of multiplier in organizations. As we have looked at the unique way multipliers drive results, I found the practices remarkably similar to another world that I knew. This is the world driven by intellectual assets and investment multiples, where technology and business leaders develop other leaders in search of growth and returns and the creation of wealth. This is a world whose nerve center is just a mile from my house. On Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, California, home to Silicon Valley's venture capital community, multi-million dollar investment decisions are made many times daily. Venture capital firms scour industries looking for to invest in emerging technologies and young companies destined to become the industry leaders of the future. When a venture firm places its bet and invests a round of funding, it draws up a term sheet to govern the deal. Of particular interest to all parties is the specification of ownership levels. These ownership levels outline the relative ownership for the business post-investment and dictate expectations for leadership and for accountability. Simply put, the term sheets let the parties know who is in charge. Once ownership of the new company is established, the venture firm cuts a check and the investment of resources begins. This funding provides the financial resources to secure capital, intellectual property, and the human resources to fuel the business. But the value isn't limited to the financial resources. The real value often emerges from the insight and coaching to startup company the company receives from the senior partners at the venture firm. These investment partners are men and women who have grown businesses, incubating technology, and often manage very large companies themselves. They not only invest the capital of the fund, they invest their know-how into these nascent companies. They coach the CEO, they lend their Rolodex to assist with business development and sales, and they work with the management team to ensure financial targets can be met. After infusing capital and know-how, the venture partners look for expected returns. The returns in the marketplace may be years away, or they may never materialize, but they keep watching for key milestones. The accountability is clear. If the company produces expected results, a second or third round of funding is likely. Otherwise, the company is left to make it on their own or die on the vine. Similarly, in their role as investors, multipliers define ownership up front and let other people know what is within their charge and what they're expected to build. They invest the genius of others in a similar way. They teach and they coach. They back people up, infusing the resources they need to be successful and to be independent. As multipliers compete, the same investment cycle as they demand accountability for others. They understand that this accountability isn't ruthless. It is the draw that creates the extraordinary growth of intelligence and the capabilities of in others. We'll look at each of these three steps in turn. One, define ownership. Two, invest resources. Three, hold people accountable. Number one, define ownership. Investors begin this cycle by establishing ownership up front. They see intelligence and capability in the people around them, and they put them in charge. Name the lead. When John Chambers, CEO of Cisco, hired his first vice president, Doug Allred, into the company, he gave the new VP of customer support control and made sure the respective roles were clear. He said, quote, "Doug, when it comes to how we run this area of the company, you get 51% of the vote, and you're 100% responsible for the result. Keep me in the loop and consult with me as you go." Weeks later, when Doug was updating John on progress, John responded with, quote, "I knew you'd surprise me on the upside," unquote. And it wasn't just Doug who received majority voting rights. John gives 51% of the vote to every member of his management in their respective areas of accountability. If your boss had told you that you own 51% of the vote, how would you operate? Would you second-guess yourself and run all the decisions by him? Or would you swing in the opposite direction and make decisions without consulting him? You probably would do neither. Most likely, you would consult your boss on important decisions to get a second opinion. And on the smaller stuff, you might be wise to ignore him or her as needed to get your job done. Giving someone 51% of the vote and full ownership creates certainty and builds confidence, enables them to stop second-guessing and start getting second opinions. Clarifying the role that you will play as a leader actually gives people more ownership, not less. They then understand the nature of your involvement and when and how you will invest in their success. And most important, they understand that they hold the majority ownership position and that success or failure hinges on their efforts. Give ownership for the final end goal. A management team is assembled for an off-site meeting to plan an important acquisition for their business. They kick off their work with a simple but powerful management exercise called the big picture. The team divides into 9 pairs, and each pair is given a 1-inch square from a photo of a famous modern painting. Each team is tasked with creating a reproduction and enlargement of its piece of the picture. In other words, each team is given a little piece of a bigger picture. The goal for the team is to bring all the enlargements together to form a unified replica of the original painting. The result should be a painting that is technically accurate and flows together seamlessly. The challenge is that no pair has seen the big picture. You can imagine what happens first. Each pair, energized by the challenge, studies their one-inch square and begins to replicate it onto a large piece of paper in front of them. They dive into the task, make their sketches, and soon color erupts everywhere. As the time allotted for the first phase of work expires, they start turning their attention to their neighboring colleagues in the room. They begin to connect the pieces and notice that the painting isn't coming together very well. The lines don't match up. The colors don't blend. Their creation is looking like a Franken painting. The session leader reminds them that their job is to optimize the whole, not their individual piece. They start to pay attention to the bigger picture. They rework their sections, focusing on integration and blending, although it is far too late to create a seamless product. The team delivers the big picture, but it remains a patchwork only moderately resembling the original artwork. When people are given ownership of only a piece of something larger, they tend to optimize that portion, limiting their thinking to the immediate domain. However, when people are given ownership for the whole, they stretch their thinking and challenge themselves to go beyond their scope. When George Scheinier, Intel division manager for EEPROM memory chips, was building his management team, he staffed it with leaders from each of the functions in the business value chain: engineering and design, manufacturing, marketing, and sales. These leaders had come from other divisions within Intel and were accustomed to being measured on the performance of their particular function. The sales leader was measured on success with sales, the marketing leader on market share, and the manufacturing leader on quality. But George did something different. He asked each member of his management team to assume the same measure of success: profit for the division. The team rallied to ensure the success of the whole division. They managed their individual function, but they readily contributed to solving the challenge in other parts of the business. They offered their full brain power to the team. Perhaps this is one reason why a member of the management team described the experience in this way: it was our business, and we were winning. There was an exciting pressure. I felt like the smartest guy on the planet. So we're going to continue looking at this quite interesting book. We're going to continue to look at the role of the investor and how they can expand their role by expanding the freedom of the team, how they invest resources, how they teach and coach, how they provide backup to their team, and how they hold people accountable. These are all things we're going to be looking at in future shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Hello to you all.